found, but there were no steps there. Jackie and Bobby got into the hearse and drove off, leaving the president and first lady in the doorway. The next day, according to a diary kept by a cabinet member, apparently Orville Freeman, who spoke to Johnson, Johnson said that when the plane came in, they paid no attention to him whatsoever, but they took the body off the plane, put it in the car, and departed. And only then did he leave the plane without any attention directed or any courtesy toward him, then the President of the United States. But he said he just turned the other cheek. He said, "What can I do? I do not want to get in a fight with the family, and the aura of Kennedy is important to us." Turning the other cheek must have been hard, as was evidenced by remarks he made in a television interview during his retirement. Asked about the incident, he said at first that he couldn't recall it. Even if such a thing had occurred, he said, "I would not have felt any offense in a critical period like that and carrying the burden and troubles that he, Bobby, was carrying." But then, when asked whether the manner of the removal of President Kennedy's body had been a surprise to you, he replied, "Yes, it didn't occur to me that the ramp would be removed and we would not be privileged to go down the same ramp with the body." He had never asked why that had been done, he said. "I just observed it, as I did a good many things." He was to call Bobby's actions, in the words of one writer, a deliberate snub. "He ran so that he would not have to pause and recognize the new president," he said to another. The television cameras at Andrews had shown America, an America that had been out of touch with its president for more than 2 hours, the darkened runways at the airbase, and then the plane's long shape gliding out of the shadows, taxiing toward the spectators and a group of cabinet officials, and then turning so that its whole length was in front of them, still in the dark. And then the floodlights were switched on, and for a moment, as one observer wrote, the scene, the waiting for Air Force One beneath the glare of television Klieg lights, seemed to be one that had been enacted many times in the past when the president was returning from a triumphant tour of Europe or a non-political jaunt across America. But this time, a truck, with a tappet and hydraulic lift holding the room-size metal container, brightly lit inside and open at both ends so the watchers could see into it, in a way it was a giant picture frame, was wheeled up to the plane's door, and when the door was opened, there was, as Mary McGrory wrote, no familiar graceful figure fingering a button of his jacket, waiting to smile, waiting to wave. Instead, what appeared in the frame were the backs of a little group of men bent over, holding something heavy and tugging it into the container, and then the viewers could see what they were tugging, the reddish bronze box glistening in the light as it lay on the floor of that brightly lit yellow frame. Then the men straightened up, and there in the frame was what McGrory called the old guard of the dead president, and his wife and brother. The container, the tableau inside, of the box and the men standing beside it and the widow and the brother, was lowered to the truck bed. The gray ambulance hearse backed into position near it, and a 10-man Marine honor guard marched up beside it, and the coffin was lifted into the hearse. And then Jackie and Bobby got in, and the ambulance pulled away, followed by a line of limousines. The television cameras swung to follow the ambulance as it left the airport, driving past another honor guard, rifles at the salute. As it was leaving, a television reporter said, "President Lyndon B. Johnson and Mrs. Johnson are standing in the door of the plane," but the cameras did not swing to show the new president and his wife until the ambulance had disappeared out of the airport. Then there was the pause while the white presidential stairs were wheeled up to replace the truck lift. It wasn't long, less than 2 minutes, but it was a pause, a gap during which, after the hearse pulled away, the Johnsons were kept waiting in the door. And after they came down, young blood behind them, the agent's eyes flickering constantly around the figures in the darkness beyond the floodlights, there was another delay. About a dozen microphones for radio and television stations, poles with speakers on them at which Johnson was supposed to give his statement, had been set up on a broad expanse of the tarmac. There was no podium, no presidential seal, only the cluster of poles. When he walked over to them after getting a report from Bundy that there was no indication of a foreign plot, since no country, including the Soviet Union, was doing anything to exploit the situation, The roar of the engines of the two army helicopters waiting to take him and his party to the White House and the thump-thump of their whirling rotors was so loud that he realized no one would be able to hear him. He sent Youngblood to speak to the pilots, but the noise didn't abate noticeably, and he motioned the agent over to him again and said, "Are we ready? Ask them if they're ready." And Youngblood went over again. The noise remained deafening, and the lights were glaring blindingly into the Johnson's eyes. He and Ladybird had to stand alone before the little group of microphones on the bare, garishly lit concrete, in a setting with no dignity about it at all, for a long, awkward few minutes, until the engines were throttled back a bit. Despite Youngblood's requests, the pilots didn't turn them off, saying they needed to keep them warm for a quick takeoff. Although it was a situation in which it was difficult for a person to keep his poise, Johnson kept his. He showed not a trace of irritation. The command he had imposed on himself did not slip for an instant. His face remained expressionless as he and his wife stood alone in the harsh lights. He read his few words with their poignant ending. "I will do my best. That is all I can do. I ask for your help and God's," slowly and solemnly. He was very reassuring, and I think for the country to hear the new president was a reassuring thing, said one TV newsman, even though, as another said, because of the noise in the place it was hard to hear his words. He assigned people to the helicopters, making himself heard was so difficult that he cupped his hand around Valenti's ear as he shouted, "Get in the second chopper and come to my office as soon as you can." Climbed into the first one, and they lifted off and wheeled toward Washington, their blinking red lights disappearing into the darkness. The flight was only 11 minutes long, but before it was over, sitting in the front compartment with Lady Bird, McNamara, Bundy, and Paul, he asked the right questions. Any important matters pending? To McNamara, what was the impact of the assassination on foreign governments? To determine that the foreign situation was indeed stable, and found the right words, eloquent words. He had to keep these men in his administration. Leaning toward the three Kennedy men, hunched forward in his intensity, he said, "President Kennedy did something I could never have done. He gathered around him the ablest people I've ever seen, not his friends, not even the best in public service, but the best anywhere. I want you to stay. I need you. I want you to stand with me." The job had been done. No other words could have better appealed to Bundy's sense of himself and his duty to the presidency, his biographer said. The shakiness he had felt when he spoke to Johnson in Dallas was suddenly gone now. Ball, who found Johnson surprisingly stable, more so than I would have been, felt that his words were especially moving. McNamara was, as always, McNamara, cold, efficient, focusing on the task to be done. All three remained in their posts. Then all at once the windows of the helicopter were filled with a huge, shining white shape, the floodlit Washington Monument, and swerving close around it, the helicopter began to descend. The reporters gathered on the south lawn of the White House had seen red lights blinking far out beyond the monument and heard the faint pop-pop sound from the whirling rotors. Then, seemingly in an instant, the pop-pop had become a deafening roar. The helicopter was hovering over the lawn, a second copter in view now right behind it. The wind from the big blades shook the trees around the lawn as if there was a storm and cut through the tall spraying waters of the fountain beyond the lawn, one reporter wrote, like an invisible knife. Following Youngblood down its steps, holding Lady Bird's arm, Johnson told Liz Carpenter, "Stay with Lady Bird and help her all you can," and the two women headed for a limousine that would take them to the Elms. In the car, after rolling up the glass that separated them from the driver, "So we could talk," Ms. Carpenter said, "It's a terrible thing to say, but the salvation of Texas is that the governor was hit." "Don't think I haven't thought of that," Lady Bird Johnson replied. "I only wish it could have been me," her words revealing the depth of both Texas defensiveness and of her love for her husband. Secret Service agents speak of being willing to take a shot for the president, of an agent being willing to sacrifice his own life for his leaders. Lady Bird Johnson was saying that if by being shot she could have removed the tarnish that she feared would attach to her husband, because the assassination that had elevated him to the presidency had occurred in his state, she would have willingly accepted the bullet. Johnson, with Moyers and several other men behind him, and Youngblood walking stride for stride next to him, so close that their shoulders kept touching, headed for the White House. The doors of the Oval Office were open so that the president's desk, on a new red carpet Jackie had installed while he was away in Texas, was visible. But before he reached those doors, he veered to the right so abruptly that his right shoulder banged into Moyer's. "Don't you want to go in?" someone asked. "I'll use my office," he said, and entering the White House through the doors to Mrs. Lincoln's office, walked through her office, into the corridor outside, down the stairs, and across West Executive Avenue to the Executive Office Building. The white vice presidential flag behind his desk in 274's ceremonial office had been replaced with the blue presidential flag, and the vice presidential seals above the outer doors with presidential seals. As soon as his junior military assistant, 24-year-old Army Lieutenant Richard H. Nelson, had heard the news from Dallas, there had flashed into his mind something he had been taught as a political science major at Princeton, and how it related to his boss's return to Washington. He had to come back not as the vice president, and not as the acting president, but as the president of the United States, because this was always drummed into us in everything, the continuity of government, that the American people will carry on, will survive. Dragooning a White House guard to help, Nelson ran down to the basement, found an old presidential flag and some seals, and installed them in 274. Just the symbols that when he walked into the Executive Office Building office, he was walking into the office of the president, not the vice president. But that was the only aspect of 274 that was presidential. It was still the same undistinguished, fluorescent-lit three-room office. He would still need the large room, the ceremonial room, for meetings, and while previously there had been two desks in the secretary's office, there would have to be a lot more people working in the suite now. Not only the staff he had left in the Capitol offices, Jenkins, Reedy, and their secretaries, but the three additions, Moyers, Valenti, and Carter, he had made on Air Force One. No one knew where they would sit or what their assignments would be. Already in the EOB elevator when he, Jenkins, Bundy, and Moyers stepped in was Colonel Juanita Roberts. They shook hands with a sort of reassuring pat, and when they got out on the second floor and he was going into 274's conference room, he said, "Walter, let's have Marie take the phone calls. Juanita can take care of the people who are coming and make my appointments. You and Bill come in here." He went into the large room. Nothing worked, Nelson was to recall. Government officials were competing with telephone men, laying new wires. Among the people crowding in were Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman J. William Fulbright and veteran Democratic Foreign Policy Advisor Averill Harriman. The Secret Service blocked off the corridor outside so no one else could enter, but every phone in the three rooms seemed to be ringing. Marie Famer wouldn't get there for a while, having landed in the second helicopter. She had been separated from the rest of the group, and not knowing where Johnson was, went home, where she found messages telling her to come to 274. And Carter and Jenkins were answering the phones. Carter, just inundated by calls, Jenkins, an oasis of calm, sitting with his yellow pad in front of him, taking notes in Greg shorthand. The staff was crowding in. Mildred Stiegel, Dorothy Torito, Valenti, Nelson, Ivan Sinclair. There was no place for them all to sit, so Nelson and Sinclair pushed in more desks and chairs. More telephone men arrived, trying to set up a hotline to Moscow and enough regular lines for all the people who were going to need them. Every few minutes, a man Colonel Roberts had never seen before rushed in and handed her wire service copy from the White House pressroom tickers for her to give to Johnson. "I didn't know him, he didn't know me," she recalls. It was Mac Kilduff. "Much chaos and a lot of people running helter-skelter," Famer says. But, she says, at the center of the storm, there was a calm. Her boss. Young Nelson, when Johnson had come in, saw the same thing in this man he had known only as vice president. Total command. I mean, just his bearing. He somehow appeared to me to have grown about 7-8 inches in the course of the day. He seemed bigger than when I saw him off on the plane to Texas. Famer saw the change. Almost a different person, she says. Many, many phone calls, she says, both coming in and going out, but there was no more of that hurrying. We may have all been hurried and flurried inside, but he set the pace, and the pace was deliberate. There was no lost motion. It wasn't necessary for us to talk, Colonel Roberts says. He would say, I want such and such, and we would do it. We knew his ways, and we had always known that when there was a difficult problem, this would be the time when you would work fastest and with very little conversation. Bundy was in and out, and the president was giving him instructions about one matter after another. A person who wouldn't know either one of the two men would have assumed that they had worked with each other forever. Foreign worries were the first priority. Johnson saw Fulbright and Harriman first, and fast. And then he started making his calls. To his three living predecessors, to Eisenhower, Johnson said, I have needed you for a long time, but I need you more than ever now. According to Reedy, he used similar words to Truman. Herbert Hoover's son, Alan, said his father was too deaf to use the phone. To J. Edgar Hoover, to direct him to throw the FBI's full resources into investigating the assassination. Hanging up the phone, Hoover ordered 30 additional agents to Dallas. To Sergeant Shriver, to express condolences. He called the treasurer of the Democratic National Committee, Richard McGuire, a Kennedy man. A lot of money had been raised on the fatal Texas trip. It had gone to the committee. He told McGuire how much he needed him. I've got to rely on you more than he did. And in what might be an indication that he was thinking ahead to the 1964 election, said, You be giving some thought to what needs to be done, and when we get these things behind us the next day or two, then we'll get together. And there were calls to two of the damn smart men who had given Jack Kennedy the brilliant concepts and the brilliant words that Johnson admired. You're going to have to do some heavy thinking for me, he said to Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg. I want you to be thinking about what I ought to do. I want you to think, just think in capital letters, and think, think, think. And then talk to me tomorrow or the next day. There's nobody in town that I believe in more than you, and I've just got to have your help. Then he called the Kennedy aide he felt he needed more than any other. In explaining on the plane the importance of keeping the Kennedy team, he had said over and over, especially Sorensen. Of all Kennedy's men, none had been hit harder. McGrory had seen him at Andrews, white-faced and stricken, unseeing and unhearing. As Johnson walked through the West Wing on his way to his office, Ted Sorensen had been sitting alone at the cabinet table, weeping. Kindly, strongly, generously, he told me how sorry he was, how deeply he felt for me, how well he knew what I'd been to President Kennedy for 11 years, and that he, LBJ, now needed me even more. Sorensen said he was to recall, Goodbye, and thank you, Mr. President. Hanging up the phone, he broke into tears again, unable to face the fact that I had just addressed that title to someone other than John F. Kennedy. Arriving at the White House, the congressional leaders had headed for the Oval Office, only to be directed across the street. Jenkins seated them at the conference table in 274's outer office, while Johnson, who had hurriedly gone into the inner office, made more calls until they were all present. His 3 years of sitting silent at leaders' meetings was over. He knew what he wanted to say, that they couldn't let other countries get wrong ideas that America's foreign policies might be changed as a result of a very abrupt and sudden transition, that it was important to show that the country was unified, that he needed the support of both parties in Congress, and what he wanted them to say to waiting reporters at the conclusion of the meeting. He had, in fact, already had Reedy draw up a statement expressing the desired sentiments, and had edited it, rewriting it heavily. Reading it to them now, he got their agreement to have Reedy issue it on their behalf. As they were filing out of 274, Reedy was typing it for distribution to the press. Writing in later years about that Friday night, Hugh Seide said that it was in Johnson's meeting with the congressional leaders that perhaps more than in anything else lay the real clue to his flawless assumption of power. The meeting had no real purpose, Seide wrote, yet it was very important. It was a kind of tribal ritual of those men who wielded the power in the legislative halls, where meetings are a way of life and a sign of authority. Once Johnson had called such meetings, summoning such men. He hadn't called one for 3 years. But now he had called one again. And, Sidey wrote, these men understood. That statement for the press wasn't the only thing Lyndon Johnson wrote that evening. Sitting at his desk in his inner office, door closed against the voices outside, he wrote two letters in longhand. Dear John, said the first, it will be many years before you understand fully what a great man your father was. His loss is a deep personal tragedy for all of us, but I wanted you particularly to know that I share your grief. You can always be proud of him. The second said, Dearest Caroline, your father's death has been a great tragedy for the nation, as well as for you, and I wanted you to know how much my thoughts are of you at this time. He was a wise and devoted man. You can always be proud of what he did for his country. He signed them both, affectionately, Lyndon B. Johnson. Even Manchester had to write of those letters, he would never be a simple man. He was capable of tactlessness and tenderness, cunning and passion. Then he was almost done with his office work for the evening. He telephoned the young man who had always been closer to him than any of his other aides, and to whom he talked in a kidding tone that he didn't use often with the others. I'm going to be leaving here soon, he said without preamble when Buzz picked up the phone. I'll come by and pick you up. You wait at the curb. And when Buzz, knowing that with the world watching on the evening of an assassination, the new president should not stop on Connecticut Avenue and pick someone up, said that he would drive to the Elms in his own car, Johnson asked in the old kidding tone, What's the matter? Are you running from the press? It was 9:24 p.m. Valenti, who had received an order to get on the plane and then one to get on the helicopter, now received one to get in the car. Drive home with me, Jack. You can stay at my house tonight, and then we'll have a chance to do some talking. Are you ready to leave now? Still, he was to say, not sure precisely why I was even here in the first place. Gathering up Carter and Moyers as well, Johnson led them out to his car, two Secret Service agents in front of them, two behind, Youngblood at his shoulder. Two agents were already sitting in the front seat, a convertible full of agents behind. As Johnson got into the car, two of the agents stood up, automatic rifles in their hands. Then, as the White House gates swung open ahead of them and the two cars pulled out onto Pennsylvania Avenue, a half-dozen waiting police motorcycle outriders swung out in front of them, their sirens wailing. At the other gates, at the Elms, men were holding shotguns as well as pistols. The street around them was filled with reporters, television mobile units, telephone trucks, and telephone linemen hooking up the new secure lines, and a cluster, surprisingly small in reporters' memories, of neighbors and onlookers. Busby, arriving at the Elms a few minutes earlier, had seen at once that the aura of the office preceded the man he had worked for so long. No one wanted to be in the foyer when the new president came in. It was conspicuously empty. When people crossed through it, they hurried their steps. Yet they wanted to see him coming in. Whenever the front door opened to admit a Secret Service agent or a telephone installer, faces appeared at the five other doorways that opened off the foyer, peeking around door frames to see if the sound meant that he had come. When he did indeed come, Busby counted 16 faces, including my own, at the doorways. Walking through the hallway to the sunroom at the back of the house, Johnson sprawled down in the big green chair. Framed in each of the French doors, there was suddenly a Secret Service man, his back to the windows. Asking for a glass of orange juice, Johnson raised it in a toast toward the grim photograph on the wall. "Hello, Mr. Sam. Sure wish you were here tonight," he said. Dr. J. Willis Hurst, Johnson's cardiologist, was waiting in the sunroom. Hearing the reports that Johnson had gone into Parkland Hospital rubbing his left arm, Dr. Travell had called him. Johnson told Hurst he had no pain in his arm, and observing him, Hurst was reassured about his health. Busby, observing him from a different perspective, was reassured in other ways. He saw in an instant that his calmness was only a facade. He was more controlled than calm. But he saw also that the control, the composure and cool-headedness, was complete. After watching television for a few minutes, Johnson said, "I guess I know less than anybody about what's happening in the United States." Then the films on the screen were of Kennedy's appearance in Fort Worth that morning. Raising his hand as if to shield his eyes from the screen, he said, "I don't believe I can take that. It's too fresh." And the channel was changed to one showing, first, films of Kennedy's early career and then films of his own. An announcer mentioned the plane bringing the cabinet members back to Washington. "That's the last damn time that the president, the vice president, and six cabinet members are going to be out of Washington at the same time, I can tell you that," he said. Calling in the head of the Secret Service, James J. Rowley, he told him about Youngblood protecting his body with his own. "I want you to do whatever you can, the best thing that can be done for that boy," he said. He told Busby to get Nellie Connolly on the phone and asked her about the governor's condition. "Take care of Johnny," he said at last. "I need him now." He told Valenti, Moyers, and Carter that they could sleep at the Elms, told Valenti he could stay there or at the White House when he, Johnson, moved in until he found a place to live in Washington. And in a low voice, almost to himself, he repeated over and over as if he was working himself up, preparing himself, the same sentence. "We really have a big job to do now." At about midnight, Busby left for his home after a conversation in which Johnson said, "You know, almost all the issues now are just about the same as they were when I came here 30 years ago." Those issues were still on the table, he said, and he intended to get action on some of them. He went upstairs and directed Moyers, Valenti, and Carter to the bedrooms they were to use, but they had only begun undressing when he called them on the intercom and told them to come to his room because, "I want to think out my agenda." Johnson was in bed in striped pajamas, propped up against a pillow with memoranda and reports spread out around him. Mrs. Johnson was in bed in another room. The three men pulled up chairs next to the bed. The men didn't talk much. Very little input from them was required. Lyndon Johnson just wanted, Carter was to say, a sounding board. The agenda he was planning was his schedule for the next day, what he had to do, what people he should see, what he should say to them. There was the cabinet meeting. What time should it be? What White House staffers should be invited to attend? What should he say there? He had to meet with Eisenhower. What did he want to accomplish at that meeting? What did he want to say to him? Buzz should be told to draft talking points. Pulling out a notebook, Valenti started scribbling frantically. What legislation was most urgent? What could he do to get it passed? Who in the House and the Senate should he talk to about it? The budget and the tax bill that was tied in with it in particular. How to deal with Harry Byrd? Harry Truman had given an address to a joint session of Congress the day after Roosevelt's funeral. He wanted to give one too. When should it be scheduled? What should he say in it? Who should draft it? We sat and talked so long, we were talking about the many, many details of things that needed to be done, the bases that needed to be touched with foreign governments, with governors, with senators, congressmen, mayors, certain things with the cabinet members, Cliff Carter was to say. Some of the things were sensitive, because if he appeared to be assuming power quickly, he might offend the Kennedys. But if he didn't, the public might not see that the government was in firm hands. Everything was weighed out to make sure that he was walking this chalk line not to overdo, but yet where the people had confidence that he could do the job. All this time the television set was on, and the newscaster's words would remind him of other things. Harry Truman was mentioned. "By God, I'm going to pass Harry Truman's medical insurance bill," he said. The three men around the bed sat silently. The men in the bed talked and talked. He didn't want advice. He knew what should be done the next day. He just wanted to lay it out. That whole night he seemed to have several chambers of his mind operating simultaneously, Moyers was to say. It was formidable, very formidable. Valenti kept scribbling things to be done on his pad. 10 pages were to be covered with notes. He gave them the next morning to a secretary to have them typed up, but they were lost. "Do you realize how valuable they would be?" he was to moan to the author years later. There was the question of who was going to carry out the tasks listed on the pad. Johnson made clear that they were all on his staff now. He told Moyers that he wanted him back from the Peace Corps, Carter says. He told Valenti to take a 2-year leave of absence from his public relations firm because he would be working at the White House, and he told Carter to move over to the Democratic National Committee to represent his interests there. Johnson started to firm things up, mapping out an hour-by-hour schedule of what he would be doing Saturday. He stopped talking at about 3 a.m. It was about 20 hours since he had woken up in Fort Worth that morning. "Well, good night, boys," he said. "Get a lot of sleep fast. It's going to be a long day tomorrow." Chapter 14. Three Encounters. At about 4:30 a.m., while Johnson was sleeping, the autopsy was finally completed at Bethesda Naval Hospital, and the coffin was brought by that gray Navy ambulance to the White House, Bobby and Jackie sitting in the back beside it. Jackie was still wearing the pink suit, and was carried into the East Room by a Marine honor guard. Jackie had sent word that she wanted the room to look as it did when Lincoln's body lay there, Dick Goodwin recalls, and sketches from 1865 had been located, and black crepe had been draped in folds over the long gold curtains and the three crystal chandeliers. A catafalque, similar to Lincoln's, a black stand on a black base, had been found and set up in the center of the room. A group of Kennedy aides was standing in a far corner of the room when the coffin was carried in. Jackie followed it, Bobby beside her, Kenny and Larry behind. Her face was fixed straight ahead, lovely, painful to see, Dick Goodwin says. Walking over to the coffin, she knelt on the floor, turned her face away so that the watching group could not see, and rested her cheek on the flag that draped the long box. Then she put her arms around it. Anyone who hadn't been crying before was crying now. After a while, she got up. The aides followed the Kennedys out of the room. There was still a decision to be made. Jackie wanted the coffin closed so that the world would remember her husband as he had been. McNamara said it must be open because the world would demand to see the body of a head of state. A hard decision, so it was made by the man who made those decisions. Going back into the East Room alone, he had the casket opened so he could see his brother's face. After a while, he came out and asked Arthur Schlesinger to go in and look. "For a moment, I was shattered," Schlesinger recalls. "It was not a good job." "Close it," Robert Kennedy said. Tall candles stood flickering at each corner of the catafalque, and at each corner also was a man in uniform with his rifle at parade rest, guarding it. At the head of the coffin stood the honor guard's commander, a Navy lieutenant, of course, rigidly at attention. At two wooden prie-dieus knelt two priests in cassocks, praying. Robert Kennedy's face had been pale and sad, but set, resolute, and apparently calm. He went up to the Lincoln bedroom, still seemingly so controlled, says Charles Spaulding, who went upstairs with him. "There's a sleeping pill around here somewhere," Spaulding said, found one, gave it to him, and then closed the door. "Then I just heard him break down. I heard him sob and say, 'Why, God?'" For Lyndon Johnson, Saturday could hardly have gotten off to a worse start. Arising after only a few hours' sleep, he breakfasted and left for the White House at 8:40, planning to begin working on the agenda he had outlined during the night. Instead, he began with a confrontation with Robert Kennedy. McGeorge Bundy had told Johnson Friday evening that he would be able to move into the Oval Office Saturday morning, but subsequently the National Security Advisor had learned that that would not be a good idea, and going to the Executive Office Building early Saturday morning, 8:05 a.m., he left a note for Johnson there, telling Mildred Stegall to give it to him as soon as he came in. "When you and I talked last night about when the president's office in the West Wing would be ready, I thought possibly it would be immediately," the note said. "However, I find they are working on President Kennedy's papers and his personal belongings, and my suggestion would be that if you could work here in the EOB today and tomorrow, everything will be ready and clear by Monday morning." Johnson, unfortunately, didn't get the message. Emerging from his limousine at about 8:55, he didn't go to the EOB, but walked into the West Wing instead, to the Oval Office, and walked in on Evelyn Lincoln as she was beginning to pack up Jack Kennedy's belongings. "I have an appointment at 9:30, he said. Can I have my girls in your office by 9:30? That would give her a half hour to pack. I don't know, Mr. President, she said. Grief-stricken and appalled, in a friend's words, she walked out of the office and began to cry, just as Bobby walked in. Sobbing, she said, Do you know he asked me to be out by 9:30? At Bethesda Hospital the previous evening, Bobby had been, Evan Thomas says, a commanding figure, making funeral arrangements, giving orders, in Jackie's name just as he had in Jack's. He kept telling little jokes, trying to keep everyone's spirits up. Composed, withdrawn, resolute was how Arthur Schlesinger saw him. He was clearly emerging as the strongest of the stricken, Ben Bradley said. But Schlesinger says, within he was demolished. He didn't know where he was. Everything was just pulled out from under him. Only the two words Spaulding heard because Bobby Kennedy didn't know anyone would hear had revealed the depth of his anguish. But when Mrs. Lincoln told him what Johnson had asked her, he blurted out, Oh, no. Not wanting to talk to Johnson in the office that had been his brother's, he went with him into the small adjoining private office and told him that crating his brother's possessions would take time, and asked him if he could wait until noon. Johnson said he could, that the only reason he had wanted to move in was that his advisers had insisted that he should. He quickly walked downstairs to the Situation Room for a briefing from Bundy and CIA Director McCone, and then went across the street to room 274. He didn't return to the Oval Office at noon. He didn't return to it for 3 days. The confrontation had been due to a misunderstanding, a mix-up, Bundy called it. And he explained that to both Kennedy and Johnson later that day, but between these two men, the blackest interpretation was placed on every action. A misunderstanding was only a new cause for rage. Johnson felt that in pushing past him on the plane at Andrews, Bobby ran so that he would not have to pause and recognize the new president. Perhaps some such thought contributed to Robert Kennedy's haste, Schlesinger commented, but a man more secure than Johnson would have sympathized with the terrible urgency carrying him to his murdered brother's wife. And he saw not only personal but political motives in the Oval Office scene. To Johnson, it was part of a plot. During all of that period, he was to say years later, I think Bobby seriously considered whether he would let me be president, whether he should really take the position that the vice president didn't automatically move in. I thought that was on his mind every time I saw him in the first few days. I think he was seriously considering what steps to take. For several days, he really kept me out of the president's office. I operated from the executive office building because the Oval Office was not made available to me. It was quite a problem. And that afternoon at 2:30 was the cabinet meeting, and the attorney general was a member of the cabinet. It couldn't have been an easy meeting for the Kennedy men who had sat at the cabinet table, or like Ted Sorensen, against the wall behind the man who had presided over past meetings, his personality dominating the room. Now Jack Kennedy was lying in a coffin not far away. Several of the cabinet members and White House staffers had come to the meeting directly from the East Room with its catafalque. As they entered the cabinet room, they could see in the hallway beyond it, by the Oval Office door, Jack Kennedy's rocking chair sitting, upside down, on a mover's dolly. Bundy had written a note to Johnson advising him to keep the meeting very short. A number of them, and perhaps still more of the others who regularly attend the cabinet, are still numb with personal grief. It couldn't have been an easy meeting for Lyndon Johnson. It had been in the cabinet room that he had had to sit, powerless and silent, through so many meetings. In the cabinet room that, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Robert Kennedy's hostility to him had been so vividly displayed. The men sitting around the long table knew who had thereafter been invited to the final decision-making meeting on Cuba, and who hadn't. As Johnson, sitting now in the president's place, opened the meeting with a prepared statement, one chair at the table was empty, the attorney general's. Robert Kennedy had agreed that the meeting should be held. His only request was that there be no pictures. At the last minute, however, he may have been unable to bring himself to attend it. I was upset by the conversations he had had with Johnson in Dallas and by the morning's confrontation, he was to explain. So by this time I was rather fed up by him. But I went by, and Mac Bundy said it was very important that I come in. So I went. Bundy himself said that Bobby was late and perhaps would not have attended if I had not told him he must. He had virtually to drag him into the room, he was to say. If those statements are correct, the National Security Advisor may have made another mistake. When Bobby entered the room, his face was so racked with grief that men who hadn't seen him since the assassination were shocked. Johnson was speaking, but several of the cabinet members stood up and remained standing as the Attorney General walked to his chair. Johnson didn't stand up, and as soon as Kennedy sat down, continued his statement. To Agriculture Secretary Orville Freeman, watching Robert Kennedy, it was quite clear that he could hardly countenance Lyndon Johnson sitting in his brother's seat. When Johnson finished, "The president is dead. The president must keep the business of this government moving. None of us in this room can really express the sadness we all feel. Yet we have work to do, and must do it. I want you all to stay on. I need you." Dean Rusk and Adlai Stevenson spoke, pledging their support to the new president, and the meeting quickly ended. Awful, was how Willard Wirtz described it. Almost mechanical. "A drab little meeting," Bundy said. Back in EOB 274, Johnson raged about Kennedy. When Orville Freeman, who was taking every opportunity to be in Johnson's presence, walked over to the EOB to discuss the meeting with him, Johnson said that Kennedy had arrived late on purpose to ruin the effect of his statement. He had already learned, he said, that Kennedy had told an aide that "we won't go in until he has already sat down." There was real bitterness in Lyndon's voice on this one, Freeman wrote in his diary. When Manchester later passed on this story, Arthur Schlesinger wrote, "Kennedy expressed amazement at first, then amusement." Bitter or not, however, Lyndon Johnson had to deal with Robert Kennedy again that afternoon, for there was still the question of when he should address Congress. Harry Truman had delivered his speech to the joint session on the day following Franklin D. Roosevelt's funeral, believing that to reinforce the aura of continuity, it was important that the nation hear the new president in a formal setting as soon as possible. Another argument to support Johnson's feelings that his speech should be given the day after Kennedy's funeral, on Tuesday, in other words, was that Thursday was Thanksgiving, and wanting to be home for the holiday, many congressmen might be leaving Washington on Wednesday. "I'll make it Tuesday if I can," Johnson told House Speaker McCormick. "I can't sit still. I've got to keep the government going." But there was the matter of keeping the Kennedy aura. "I don't want the family to feel I have any lack of respect, so I have a very delicate wire to walk here." If Johnson had any doubts about which of the two considerations, continuity or aura, was more important, McCormick, a very shrewd politician, helped dispel them, if tactfully. "On the question of Tuesday or Wednesday," he said, "don't you let that disturb you at all. It's a delicate field for all. You should respect the delicacy. That's all I say, and this is of paramount importance and gravity." A Tuesday speech, Johnson told a visitor that day, might be resented by the family. When Johnson suggested Tuesday, he found out how deep that resentment might be. "I didn't like that," Robert Kennedy was to recall. "I thought we should just wait one day, at least one day after the funeral." He communicated his feelings to Bundy, but Johnson sent Bundy back to him saying that they was unidentified, wanted on Tuesday. Kennedy's response was an angry, "Well, the hell with it. Why do you ask me about it? Don't ask me what you want done. You'll tell me what it's going to be anyway. Just go ahead and do it." Johnson didn't give up, sending a Kennedy relative, Sergeant Shriver, as an emissary, but Kennedy's response was even angrier. "Why does he tell you to ask me? Now he's hacking at you. He knows I want him to wait until Wednesday." Shriver reported this response to Johnson. Without a word, the president picked up his telephone and, angrily, punching one button after another, said a single terse sentence to each person he was calling. "It will be on Wednesday." Lyndon had had to deal with Robert Kennedy three times Saturday. After the first of those encounters, he had had to retreat from the Oval Office. The second had resulted in his cabinet meeting being ruined. In the third, he had had to give in on the scheduling of his speech. In some ways, that Saturday was a reprise of his 3 years as vice president. Constant conflict with Robert Kennedy, and constant defeat. Given the importance of keeping the support of the Kennedy faction, there was nothing he could do about it. He told Reedy to announce that he would not move into the Oval Office until Tuesday, the day after the funeral. For 3 days, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, he would work out of room 274. Chapter 15. The Drums. A hard rain had begun to fall just before daybreak on Saturday. Through it, on the television cameras, shooting with long-range lenses from Lafayette Park across Pennsylvania Avenue. The White House looked gray, the November bare limbs of the trees in front of it black from the rain, the remaining leaves sodden and dark. Through the rain all that day, black limousines pulled up to the north portico, with its familiar lantern and its black-draped doorway, one after the other, in an endless line, and as the car doors opened, Marines, snapping to attention with their heels hitting the pavement so loudly that the click was picked up by television microphones, outstepped senators and ambassadors, Dobrynin clasping his hands together and trying to keep his composure, generals and admirals, in uniforms stiff with medals and braid, men who had to be identified by the newscasters, 71-year-old John McCormick with his shock of snow-white hair, 86-year-old Carl Hayden, laboriously climbing the stairs with a cane supporting him on one side and a policeman on the other, and men with faces everyone knew, Truman, Eisenhower. One by one, or couple by couple, they walked up the steps between rigid men in dress uniforms with rifles held high. The Chief Justice and his wife. When they emerged after viewing the casket, Mrs. Warren could no longer maintain her composure, and, during the long minutes while the Warrens waited on the portico for their car to pull up, she stood weeping. Dusk fell, the rain continued, through it the great lantern shone. As each car was pulling up to the stairs, its headlights swept across the white columns. On the second floor of the White House, to the left of the portico in the living quarters, there was a single lit window. And television, cutting away from the portico to West Executive Avenue, showed America other pictures that day, of the removal of the late president's personal effects from the White House office, cartons of files, a large globe, a model of the aircraft carrier Enterprise, TV newscaster David Brinkley said in his dry voice. They were taken out the West Wing door and trundled on movers' dollies across to the EOB, where they would be stored temporarily. Then another artifact came out. When Brinkley had finished explaining to his viewers about the rocking chair, he bit his lip. Television showed the president's mother, veiled and holding her Bible, supported by two men as she made her way to morning mass in Hyannis. They couldn't show the father, for he didn't come out of his house. But TV told the world that President Kennedy's youngest brother Teddy and his sister Eunice had flown to Hyannis to break the news to the patriarch. It is said that he took it remarkably well, television reported. Television didn't get a glimpse of Jack Kennedy's children that day, and there wasn't too much information about how they had been told, or about how they had reacted, but television showed a lot of film of John Jr. and Caroline playing in the Oval Office, romping with their father. Viewers could imagine how they had reacted. Over and over on Saturday, television showed the scenes that had occurred at the White House during the previous night, at 4:30 a.m. It showed the White House and the marble gates to the horseshoe driveway, brilliantly white in TV floodlights, and the Marine Honor Guard drawn up in the driveway. As the cameras swung toward the gates, a dark shape appeared beyond them in the darkness, and as it came into the lights, it was seen to be the ambulance bringing the president's body from Bethesda. Television showed the honor guard marching, rifles high at port arms, in front of the ambulance to the portico, to the tall columns and the hanging lantern behind them, and the doorway draped in black, and it showed the coffin, covered now in a flag, being lifted out by uniformed men and carried up the steps, past other guards, hands at the salute, staring straight ahead when the widow, still in the pink suit, and the brother walked past them. Most of the country had been sleeping when those scenes occurred, but television showed them over and over that Saturday. So the country saw them as if they were happening then, that day. And before dawn, television crews had been briefly allowed into the East Room, and the film they had taken there was shown over and over again that day, so that over and over again America saw the black catafalque, like Lincoln's catafalque, the black crepe on the draperies and chandeliers, and America saw, too, two workmen, after finishing some task in the East Room in those pre-dawn hours, start to leave and then stop at the two prie-dieus and kneel and cross themselves and pray. Interspersed with all this were documentaries of Kennedy's life, images of his smile, remembrances of his wit, pictures of him with his wife and children. And then there were the replays of significant television programs in which he had participated. One of them was an hour-long interview he had held in the Oval Office with the three network correspondents, sitting relaxed and easy in the rocking chair. The country therefore saw him in his rocker, and then saw the rocker being trundled out on a dolly. And there were pictures of Lyndon Johnson, too, that Saturday, of the new president inside his car, face grim as he left the Elms, and as he turned into West Executive Avenue that morning, of him walking quickly into and out of church from his car, of him walking across West Executive to the cabinet meeting, a Secret Service agent holding an umbrella over his head. There were no television cameras in 274, as there were none in the White House. Still photographs of him sitting at the conference table with Rusk and then McNamara were shown. The first pictures of him at work as president, Brinkley said. But they didn't have much impact beside pictures of Jackie Kennedy following the coffin, or beside pictures of the honor guard, or beside pictures of what one broadcaster called the mighty of the land filing into the White House for a mournful adieu to President John F. Kennedy. The cabinet meeting had drama to it, but there were no pictures of that, live or still. Indeed, television mentioned it only briefly. There was no hint at all of what had happened between Johnson and Bobby Kennedy that morning. The new president did appear on television to read his proclamation, establishing Monday as a day of national mourning. But he simply walked up to a makeshift microphone, quickly read the statement in a minute and a half, and left the room without another word. He apparently decided just to read the proclamation and let it go at that, the newscaster said. After summing up the day's dramatic events in the White House, Brinkley added that President Johnson in the meantime was across in the executive office building, carrying on his business, meeting with the cabinet. President Johnson, said another newscaster, has been, shall we say, a little bit in the background today. Newspapers covered his activities more thoroughly, running long articles about them on the front page. President Lyndon B. Johnson took firm control of the reins of government, the Washington Post said. Mr. Johnson's day was one of brisk activity, the New York Times said. And the headlines about him were banner headlines, all across the top of the front page, just as were the headlines about Kennedy and Oswald. But the headlines about him had none of the drama of the headlines about Kennedy and Oswald. Across the top of the Washington Post's front page, for example, the headlines were, Nation's Great File Past Kennedy Beer. Body Lies in State at Capitol Today. Johnson Moves to Carry On Policies. In the New York Times, the banners were, Kennedy's Body Lies in White House. Johnson at Helm with Wide Backing. Police Say Prisoner is the Assassin. The stories about him weren't the lead stories, but only the second lead. And in any event, it wasn't from newspapers, but from television that America was getting its news that day. And then, the next morning, Sunday morning, began the roll of the drums. As the sun rose that morning, the rain gone, the pale blue sky seemingly without a cloud, the broad avenues between the White House and the Capitol were waiting, their roadways empty, the crowds lining them on the pavements packed solid, standing in silence. In front of the White House, the sounds were of horses' hooves, and the creaking of harnesses and of rolling wooden wheels. A bare black wooden platform, a caisson or artillery gun carriage, on four black wheels was pulled into the driveway and up to the north portico by six matched gray horses in pairs, a rider on the left-hand horse in each pair, the saddle on the right horse empty, as was military custom for a fallen leader. Two heavy black straps had been attached to the caisson. It stood there in front of the portico for a while, black and bare, the straps dangling. Then, without ceremony except for the coming to attention, rifles held high of the dress-uniformed men flanking the doorway and the steps down to the driveway, eight military pallbearers brought the flag-draped coffin out of the doorway and down the stairs and lifted it onto the gun carriage. The straps were laid across the coffin, black against the bright red and white stripes, and buckled fast so that it couldn't fall off. There was a pause, and suddenly, in the doorway, there she was. Jacqueline Kennedy was dressed all in black. She wasn't crying. At least there were no tears on a face that might have been the model for a portrait of grief. On either side of her was a small figure dressed in a sky-blue coat, and she took their hands. Standing behind her, a little to the side, was Robert Kennedy, expressionless, still as a statue. They stood there while the caisson began to move away down the driveway toward Pennsylvania Avenue, between soldiers and sailors holding the flags of the 50 states, who dipped them in salute as the caisson passed. The first of a line of black limousines pulled into the portico, and the Kennedys walked down the steps as Clint Hill opened the back door of the car. Behind them, the figures of Lyndon and Lady Bird Johnson came into view and came down the steps. They and the Kennedys were to ride in the same car together. They got in, Jackie and Lyndon in the rear seat, with Caroline and John Jr. sitting next to their mother, Lady Bird and Robert in the jump seats, which faced forward, with Lady Bird in front of her husband. The car pulled slowly down the driveway behind the caisson. It waited at the end of the driveway so that as the caisson came out between the gates, it came out alone. And as it came out, the drums began. Few people in Washington, few people in America, perhaps, had ever heard the sound of muffled drums. The tension on each drumhead loosened so that the resonance was deadened. With the whole corps playing muffled drums as they were playing now, the roll of those drums filled the air, melancholy, ominous, final. And it was to that sound that the caisson came out onto Pennsylvania Avenue to take its place in a column. Ahead of it, after the drum corps, priests marching abreast, three of them with their black robes billowing behind, warriors marching abreast, their medals glinting in the sun, the dead president's military aides, the joint chiefs of staff, other generals, other admirals, a company of sailors with fixed, shining bayonets, an honor guard carrying the flag of his country, and just behind the caisson bearing the dead president, carried by a single tall sailor, his own flag, the presidential standard. Shielded by the portico, the standard had hung limp, but as it came out between the gates, it was caught by a gust of wind so that it blew straight out, and the golden presidential seal with its eagle holding an olive branch in one talon and arrows in the other stood out for a moment bold against the navy blue background. Behind that flag came a riderless horse, a magnificent tall black gelding, sword in its scabbard hanging from the saddle, but in the stirrups, boots turned backwards to symbolize the fact that his fallen rider would never ride again. Since the days of Genghis Khan and Tamerlane, a riderless horse with boots reversed in the stirrups had followed fallen chieftains to their graves. Black Jack was a restless animal, always hard to control. He was prancing nervously now, tossing his head, trying to rear against the bit. Following him came the limousine carrying the Johnsons and the Kennedys, and then a line of other limousines with Kennedy relatives and the dead president's closest aides. None of the cars had its top down this time. After three blocks, the procession wheeled around the corner by the Treasury building, and suddenly, facing the marchers a mile away, rearing up, huge, gleaming, almost dazzlingly white against the clear blue sky, thrusting up out of a base so long that it seemed to fill the horizon, was the dome of the Capitol. Stretching along the base, the building that held the two chambers of Congress, were tall white marble columns and the pilasters that are the echo of columns. And the dome was circled with columns, too, circled by columns not only in its first mighty upward thrust, where it was rimmed by 36 great pillars, for the 36 states that the Union had comprised when it was built, but circled by columns also high above, hundreds of feet above Pennsylvania Avenue, where, just below the Statue of Freedom, a circle of 13 more slender shafts for the 13 original states made the Tholos, a structure modeled after the place where the Greeks left sacrifices to the gods, looked like a little temple in the sky. As the long procession moved down that broad avenue before the packed silent throng to the thunderous roll of the muffled drums, it was moving toward columns atop columns, columns in the sky, a procession carrying the body of a republic's slain ruler in all the stateliness and pomp a republic could muster toward a structure that represented and embodied all a republic's majesty. For long minutes the drums would roll and the air reverberate with their sad, fateful sound. Then the drums would stop, and so quiet was the watching crowd that in those intervals the clatter of hooves, blackjacks and those of the matched greys, and the rhythmic tread of the marching sailors echoed down the avenue. Block by block, the hush deepened, an observer wrote. General Clifton, marching with the other military aides, was to recall that all you could hear was the drums and the clump of the horses. The drums. The terrible drums, another marching general was to say. The procession from the White House to the Capitol took about 45 minutes. As the lead limousine came out of the White House gates, there was, Lady Bird Johnson was to recall, a sea of faces stretching away on every side, silent, watching faces. She would remember the flags at half-mast all along the avenue and the sailors marching in front of her. And always there was the sound of muffled drums in the background. But most vivid of all was the feeling of a sea of faces and that curious sense of silence, broken only by an occasional sob. Lady Bird sat next to the man her husband hated, and who hated him. Robert Kennedy's face was grave, white, sorrowful, she was to recall. John John, in a peripatetic mood, kept jumping back and forth from the back seat to his uncle's lap and back again, until finally Robert said, "John John, be good. You'll be good and we'll give you a flag afterwards." The only time the Attorney General said anything else, she says, was as the car passed the old Senate office building. The Attorney General looked over and said, as though to himself, or perhaps to the children, that was where it all began. That was where he ran for the presidency. There was a flinching of the jaw at that moment that almost made, well, it made your soul flinch for him, she says. Otherwise, Lady Bird says, we were a pretty silent group as we rode along, each wrapped in his own thoughts. She was to sum up that ride in a single word. Interminable. In the plaza before the Capitol's east front, Lyndon and Lady Bird got out of the car, and he helped the children and Mrs. Kennedy out. Robert got out last, without looking at Johnson. The staircase on the east front, broad and tall, was lined now on each side with a double row of men in dress blues and white gloves, rigid in salute. And the coffin of the dead president was carried up between their bayonets, flag of his country fluttering ahead of him, his own flag fluttering behind, to lie in state in the soaring stone-floored rotunda under the dome, with its friezes and paintings commemorating historic moments in the nation's past. As the coffin went up the steps, a Navy band played a sailor's hymn asking for help, for those in peril on the sea, for the president had once been in peril on the sea, and played also Hail to the Chief, but in an unusually slow tempo, so that as it was played for the last time for John Fitzgerald Kennedy, it was played as a dirge. Nothing could be harder to endure than Hail to the Chief, Kennedy's sister Jean felt. In the rotunda, the coffin lay on the very catafalque on which Lincoln's body had lain after he had been shot. In front of the circle of statues of great men of the nation's past was a circle 7 or 8 deep of the major figures of the present. And there were eulogies from McCormick, representing the House, Mansfield, representing the Senate, and the Supreme Court's Warren. During the speeches, Mrs. Kennedy stood holding Caroline's hand. John John had been taken away to Speaker McCormick's office, where one of McCormick's aides was amusing him by letting him play with flags, one of which attracted his interest. "Can I have that one?" he said, I want to take it home to my daddy. Jackie turned her face attentively toward each speaker, a reporter saw. Sometimes, he wrote, there was the shine of tears in her eyes, but her lips never trembled. Her face was still the immobile mask. They didn't tremble even when Mansfield told how in Dallas she had taken the ring from her finger and put it in the coffin. For an instant, her eyes closed, her shoulders sagged, but she caught herself and stood erect again. During the last speech, she swayed for a moment, but then the soldierly figure firmed again. Another of Jack Kennedy's sisters, Pat, was thinking, if Jackie can do it, I can. Says Lady Bird Johnson, her behavior from the moment of the shot was to me one of the most memorable things of all. Maybe it was a combination of great breeding, great discipline, great character. I only know it was great. Sometimes, Lady Bird says, she herself wanted to cry, but she felt she couldn't permit herself the catharsis of tears. One reason for that, she says, was that the dignity of Mrs. Kennedy and the members of the family demanded it. After the speeches, during which Lyndon Johnson stood in the third row of spectators behind the Kennedy family, came his moment in the ceremonies, a somewhat awkward moment. He had to place a wreath by the coffin, and the wreath, a large one on an easel, was to be carried in front of him by an army sergeant. For some reason, the sergeant walked backward as he carried the wreath and easel, facing Johnson, matching his steps to Johnson's, so that their approach to the casket resembled, to one observer, an odd dance. And then, immediately after Johnson had returned to his former place, came another moment. Jackie Kennedy and Caroline walked forward to the coffin and knelt beside it. "You just kiss," Jackie had told her daughter, and Jackie knelt, touched the flag covering the coffin, and kissed it. The little girl beside her touched the flag too, but as if she couldn't get close enough to her father that way, then put her hand under the flag to touch the coffin. The Joint Chiefs of Staff were standing at attention, tears running down their cheeks. After the ceremonies, the Johnsons followed the Kennedys down the broad steps, and they drove away, this time in separate cars. And as soon as the dignitaries had left the rotunda, the people who had been waiting were admitted. While the ceremonies had been going on, crowds that had been waiting outside to view the coffin had been joined by crowds from Pennsylvania Avenue who had followed the procession to the Capitol. And now the building was surrounded by a throng which filled the plaza all the way to the Supreme Court building and the Library of Congress, filled the streets around the Senate and House buildings, and spilled down the hill toward Union Station. And the crowd was growing. Every highway leading into Washington seemed to be jammed for miles with cars bringing more people. There would not be much to see when these people got inside, just the coffin and its guard of honor, and they would have time only to file past it and kneel quickly if they wished, yet more and more came. Dusk fell, the temperature dropped into the low 30s, yet the line of people grew longer as people joined it faster than people could be admitted to the rotunda. The lights were turned on. The great dome was illuminated by floodlights so that it loomed, beautiful and majestic, in the dark. By midnight, when perhaps 100,000 people had passed by the coffin, the line, 5 abreast of people waiting to get in, was 3 miles long and still getting longer. The people who entered the rotunda at 2:30 a.m. had been waiting in line in the cold for 8 hours. At 5:45 Monday morning, a policeman near the end of the line told people who were just arriving that they might as well go home because the doors had to be closed at 8:30 and only 85,000 more can get in, and there was no chance that they would be among them. Monday was the day of the funeral itself. As a procession was bringing the coffin back from the Capitol to the White House to be taken from there to St. Matthew's Cathedral for the funeral mass and then to Arlington National Cemetery for burial, the pageantry was suddenly at a new level. The honor guards were in it, and the flags, and blackjack, and there were also bands, their brass instruments agleam in the sun. The Marine Band in scarlet tunics, its muffled drums draped in black, playing Onward Christian Soldiers. The Navy Band marching behind the caisson. Tall tartan-clad figures, bagpipers of Scotland's Black Watch, the Royal Highland Regiment, which had played for President Kennedy at the White House, and troops of marching men, West Point cadets in gray uniforms, striding with their famed precision, the gold insignia of their headgear shining. Annapolis midshipmen in navy blue and white, Air Force cadets in lighter Air Force blue, close to half a mile of bands and troops. And when, at the White House, other marchers fell into line to walk behind the coffin the 8 blocks to the cathedral, it became a procession that was, in the Times description,